two human beings, the hostile brothers, presents the two fundamentally opposed patterns of sacrifice or offering that characterize the human psyche. Where does work, per se, enter the story? Cain and Abel both have their occupations. The former is a tiller of the ground, while the latter is a shepherd, a keeper of flocks. More subtle, however, is the presentation of the relationship between work and sacrifice, a relationship that is properly and deeply understood as a shared identity. With this identity clear, the emphasis in the biblical texts on sacrifice as characterizing the relationship between man and God, and vice versa, becomes comprehensible and of immediate practical import, as well as identifiable as perhaps the most profound and necessary of all truths. First, to render this claim of identity comprehensible, a question. What is work? If I am doing what needs to be done instead of what I want to do for the sake of present gratification, I am working. Needs to be done in what sense? And compared to what? Work is the subjugation of whim, or more precisely, its integration with other needs and desires into something of a higher and more complete order. Work is, to state it differently, the delay of gratification and a sacrifice made in the service of others. It is an investment to best ensure the beneficence of the future, whose price must be paid in the present, an investment as well in the goodwill of the others on whose behalf something valuable, time, energy, attention, has been given up now. That means that when I am working, I'm replacing what I wish I could be doing right now, replacing what would otherwise seize my immediate attention and desire, with some demand of transcendent yet still brute necessity, all things considered, with something more calculated and longer term. This giving up or offering often is and can well be considered in any case as a contractual, communal, or covenantal obligation, implicit or explicit, one designed to meet the needs and wants of others, my family, my friends, my colleagues or partners, as well, and this is more difficult to understand but crucial, as my future self. There is perhaps no pattern of action more difficult to enact than voluntary subjugation of the present to the other and the future, given the conflict of that pursuit with the powerful, appetitive, motivational, and emotional forces that strive to possess us and demand immediate gratification. Human beings are the only creatures that have ever come to understand how to subjugate now to later, routinely, as part of our mode of being, and are certainly the only creatures who determined how to ritualize, imaginatively understand, and then semantically represent that pattern of subjugation, work, and sacrifice. We had to learn all that to sacrifice, to represent the pattern of sacrifice the hard way, of course. We had to learn to work. Is there any purpose more profound for the great brains that characterize our species and require such lengthy socialization to develop than to transcend the instinctual and direct it toward the concerns of others and the future? Perhaps what developed along with that process of maturation was the ability to act out what we had learned about work, about sacrifice, so that we could understand it more deeply, dramatically, and explicitly, as well as doing the work. Doing so enabled us to transmit that understanding in the form of stories to ourselves, each other, and our children. We formulated dramatic stories about our sacrificial efforts and then attempted to analyze the stories to make the representations they had already distilled through abstraction ever more explicit, comprehensible, and memorable. At the same time, we learned how to make psychological sacrifices instead of or in addition to the concrete offerings made on altars and in temples, to identify outdated or otherwise counterproductive ideas, to let them burn away, no matter how much we once or still loved them, so that something new could rise. As we have seen, there is little or no difference between such psychological sacrifice and what we now consider, rather bloodlessly, critical thinking. The difficulty of all this should not be underestimated. It was a hard slog out of the immediacy of animal being into the realm where the future and the community mattered, even in the moment. Coming to understand what we had done and what it meant was another stunning accomplishment. What exactly are we and should we be working for, sacrificing to? These questions still plague us all in the form of meaning. What is the meaning of our effortful striving, of our lives, and the work that defines our lives? What then do we do when we work? We sacrifice the impulsive pleasures of the moment to the broader necessity of extended and social life. There is more, however. We also sacrifice, simultaneously, the multiplicity of things we could be attending to or doing, those are the same things, to a unity of present purpose. The philosopher of science, Karl Popper, said something wise that bears directly on this issue. Our knowledge can only be finite, while our ignorance must necessarily be infinite. We must work towards some small subset of goals, with every action organized under their rubrics. We must reduce that subset even further, even to unity, in order to get our priorities straight. Otherwise, our efforts work at cross purposes. This amplifies their difficulties, increases our confusion, breeds conflict, and destroys hope. It is for such reasons that the gospel states, "And if a kingdom be divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. And if a house be divided against itself, that house cannot stand." Mark 3:24-25. The complexity of work and sacrifice does not end there. We must also arrange our aims so that we can proceed in a manner that not only benefits our particular plans, but also makes us ever more able to formulate and pursue other plans, and with other people. A delicate balancing act, indeed, a difficult challenge to establish such sweeping harmony, many plates to spin and balls to juggle while standing on the ultimate tightrope. If you serve a multiplicity instead of a unity, you are confused, anxious, aimless, and hopeless. But if you serve a unity, what unity do and should you serve? The most comprehensive unity would unite psychologically, spiritually, speaking theologically, would make of the tremendous hierarchical complexity of our neural architecture something singular at the pinnacle of order or process. It would furthermore and simultaneously place that singular integrated individuality into congruence with the social world and the surrounding natural order, into harmony with the communal and natural logos. When people aim at the same targets, celebrate the same festivals, worship the same gods, they are united. This is as true psychologically as it is socially. United people typically perceive the same objects, conceptualize the same ideas, agree on friend and foe, and feel the same emotions. As individuals, they are not subject to an internal war of fractious spirits competing for possession. As members of a true society, they are not riven apart by competing gods and striving consequently in different directions. The diverse and disparate elements of their nervous systems are aiming in the same direction, in synchrony within that nervous system and between the nervous systems of different but united people. If all that is within a person has not been united in service to the same transcendent unity, he or she will be pulled apart with doubt and spiral into misery and hopelessness. If two people serve the same unity, they can work together, sacrifice together, navigate treacherous and difficult terrain together, can cooperate and compete together, and can do so voluntarily, productively, and peacefully. People aiming at the same unified target are psychologically integrated embodiments of the same spirit. This union of the individual and the collective is indistinguishable from fully socialized maturation. Imagine an audience within a stadium, theater, or church, attending a particularly significant game, watching an intense drama, or listening intently to a gripping speech. Everyone is focused and silent, eyes on the ball, or the star, or the singer, although reserving the right to burst spontaneously, as if they were one, into appreciative applause. They are all celebrating the same goal, following the same plot, attending to the same point, and deriving the same moral from the speech. These are all variations on the same theme. Consider the case of a compelling and unifying speech. When expertly delivered, a public address is a monologue, but with a communal or social quality. One person is on stage speaking, to be sure, but that speaking person is also attending and listening to the people he's addressing, and intently, if he is truly expert. He is continually and actively assessing the audience, person by person, to best ensure that each word is timed properly, landing perfectly, aimed precisely, making itself manifest in keeping with the expectations, desires, apprehensions, and hopes of the listeners. This is true even of the game, of the play, or the singer and musician, although the transformations brought about by participation in those events are more subtle and implicit, even though they may sometimes be deeper. The unity that compels attention and unites action in such circumstances is participation in a process, the dialogos, that requires of the speaker and the listener alike that old preconceptions be sacrificed and replaced by something new, more comprehensive and elegant. As P.K. Farabend, the Austrian philosopher of science, so famously noted, scientists try to eliminate their false theories. They try to let them die in their stead. The believer, whether animal or man, perishes with his false beliefs. This is an indication of the import of voluntary sacrifice in game, literature, art, and in the scientific process itself. It is a veritable substitution for death. Any occurrence of genuine depth and quality has a sacrificial element. A multiplicity is unified in a stadium or theater in a state of voluntary celebration, and so given up its diversity in service of the higher purpose. The same thing also occurs, and more explicitly, in a house of worship. That voluntary celebration, that worship, they are the same thing. This becomes particularly evident, perhaps, in the case of a musical performance, where the same melody, rhythm, and universally known and loved words grip both attention and compulsion to action, the latter being the tendency to dance, and unites. Toward what does music aim? Toward an ever-elaborating, upward-spiraling pattern of harmony, toward a state where something already compelling and harmonious and great is replaced by something still better. Up Jacob's eternal ladder to heaven. All in all, however, as you sit with eyes and ears attuned to the football field, the stage, the lectern, integrating yourself, you do so in concord with everyone else there. That is something that holds particularly true when the joint is jumping, so to speak, That is the collective and near total under optimal conditions, seizure of attention and action by the ongoing performance. The spectacle and the fact of the latter word and its concordance with the name of a device to enhance or even allow for vision is revealing. There's something deep about such seizure, something beyond the moment, even though it immerses you in that moment, something you will pay, that is, sacrifice for, something religious, by definition, insofar as the religious and that which is deep are the same thing. The religious is what most profoundly seizes attention and compels action. The religious is the calling of the depths. It is capture by the shine in the darkness of the pearl of great price. It is the apprehension of such treasure that grips the members of the most fortunate and enthusiastic audiences, those who are most effectively entertained, which means, etymologically speaking, held mutually, intertwined, engaged, delighted, and receiving hospitality. Imagine, with all this in mind, gazing upward into a star-laden sky on the darkest and clearest of nights, far from the city lights, with the infinite expanse of heaven laid in front of you. Consider the apprehension of awe thereby produced. That is, the heights calling to you in a manner that is deeply embodied, even instinctual, or more accurately, calling to the best in you. You may feel small or insignificant in comparison, but only because you confront something greater. And there is, in that very act of encountering what is greater, the realization that greater itself exists and that it can and should be strived toward. This is the paradoxical consequence, it might be said, of falling to your knees. It is simultaneously an act of humility and a revelation of what could yet be, even within. It is very difficult to unpack such experience, to make its nature explicit, in no small part, because it is the experience of the finite apprehending the infinite. That primary experience of awe in the face of the cosmos itself is, perhaps, the fundament of the religious enterprise, and the inexhaustible fundament. You could describe the nature of that encounter forever and never be finished with it. We are always seized by awe when we find ourselves in the grip of something, when our attention is focused, whether voluntarily or involuntarily, or in the strange situation where both are the case simultaneously, when we cannot help but notice, but then decide of our own accord to investigate. It is in this manner, in part, that our destiny reveals itself, where we find our calling. This is exactly what happens to Moses in his famous encounter with the burning bush. Now, Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt. And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here am I. And he said, Draw not nigh hither. Put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Exodus 3:1-6. We are always compelled by variants of the burning bush. by the encounter with something that is both enduring in its being and furiously becoming simultaneously. There is nowhere this happens more evidently than in the case of life itself, defined by its fire from within. Consider, for example, Van Gogh's paintings of sunflowers or irises, or the blooms apprehended in verse by Aldous Huxley, glowing intensely to him in his mescaline heightened state. Something is always glimmering at the periphery, trying to make itself known. And what is greatest does so when we are most truly endeavoring to aim up. We can respond or turn away from the clarion call of opportunity, of adventure. If we reject the calling, however, the doorway disappears. If we make such turning away a practice, make of such rejection the sad spirit of our life, opportunity and adventure as such disappear, leaving behind the normality our refusal has rendered dull and pointless, stripped of its magic, disenchanted and hopeless. This is one pattern of egregious sin, one of the fundamental ways we divorce ourselves from the workings of what is truly redeeming within us and outside of us. If, by contrast, we respond, opportunity deepens and multiplies until what is most profound and most truly inexhaustible makes itself manifest. This is precisely the pathway trodden by the greatest of scientists, mystics, saints, and artists. This is how God speaks from the depths of the true encounter with what flickers, flames, and lives. It is crucial to note that Moses' encounter is dialogical. God or God's angel reveals himself, but Moses has to turn aside, that is, go out of his way, deviate from his preconceived task to voluntarily attend before the revelation makes itself complete. It is the same for all of us. Our attention is gripped by phenomena that we find spontaneously interesting or by problems that bug us, shades of Pinocchio's Jiminy Cricket. If we take seriously what compels us or bothers us, that is, if we peer deeply enough into the abyss that lurks behind them, we will see and hear what we can tolerate of the Spirit of God making itself present to us. What does this mean? If you pay enough attention to anything, everything will be revealed. In this manner, Michelangelo's great statue of David is a burning bush, the revelation of a great opportunity. The problem of the evil of Auschwitz is a burning bush, the revelation of a terrible problem with an equally dramatic and valuable solution. The Holy Spirit itself is the compelling dialectic of calling and conscience. The snitch encountered by the boy wizard Harry Potter in J.K. Rowling's multi-volume drama is a symbol of the former, making its appearance to the seeker, and a manifestation of the spirit Mercurius or Hermes, the winged messenger of the gods, an emissary of the dream world of the unconscious, a psychopomp who flits on the border between the human and the divine. The cricket plays the role of the latter, the conscience, for the marionette Pinocchio, who is aiming to become a real boy, impeded though he might be by the temptations of pride and arrogance, deceit and hedonism. The attention-getting chirp of the cricket is what bugs us, what sets off the cognitive equivalent of the primordial parasite and predator detection systems we refer to when we say, something is really bugging me, or it really got under my skin. Shades of the plagues of flies and locusts that later bedevil the intransigent and tyrannical, resentful, murderous, genocidal Pharaoh of the Exodus account. It is by no means coincidence that the diminutive companion of the puppet boy striving to realize himself shares initials with the savior of the Christian tradition. God is the ultimate up in the upward aim, the work that truly redeems, the work that is truly pleasing to God. That is the complete sacrifice of all for what is truly highest. It is that work that God calls upon Cain and Abel and us all to undertake. We undertake that work in the twin manners characterizing the adversarial brothers. 3.2, the hostile brothers of good and evil. We have discussed what unites us, the drama or story that unifies our perceptions. Let us now consider what divides us. More specifically, what does so most deeply? The conflicts that divide us both within and without can be most profitably conceptualized as battles between the stories that inhabit or possess us at our voluntary invitation and through which we view the world. If two or more people are locked in conflict, it is because the ways they specify their attention differ, and sometimes at a profound level. That is not the mere consequence of differing opinions, say, about the putatively same set of facts. It is something much more fundamental, because the facts, or more accurately, the set of facts that reveal themselves to you, are a function of the story you have overlaid on the source from which you are deriving information. The story is a description of the structure through which the world is prioritized, and the conflicts that divide us a matter of differing aim or will. Knowing this, you might ask, what stories most fundamentally clash? To put it differently, what is the most basic of oppositions? Or what spirits or characters are most antagonistic to one another? It is in the story of Cain and Abel that we find the first focused characterization of this conflict, war, or internal division. Remember, once again, that Cain and Abel are also the first two real human beings, as Adam and Eve are made directly by God, and in the garden before the fall, rather than being born in the profane world of history. It is very telling, therefore, that the two brothers exist in absolute conflict, a terrible dramatization of human destiny. As the Soviet dissident Alexander Solzhenitsyn so famously put it, the line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart and through all human hearts. This line shifts. Inside us, it oscillates with the years, and even within hearts overwhelmed by evil, one small bridgehead of good is retained. Some of that essential fraternal conflict is social, familial in its most basic social manifestation, and then, more broadly, a consequence of comparatively abstract social structuring. Both levels of strife are held to simultaneously characterize the primordial brothers. And Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bare Cain and said, "I have gotten a man from the Lord." And she again bare his brother Abel, and Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. Genesis 4:1. It is a miracle how much information can be compacted into so little space. To truly understand even these few lines, we must consider the frequent reality of sibling rivalry and, in a broader social context, the conflict of interest that constantly emerges between, for example, farmer and rancher. With regard to the former, intrafamilial sibling rivalry is common, perhaps to the point of normative. This can all too easily become something pathologically extreme. Siblings who encounter chronic, intense levels of this rivalry are at risk for a range of negative outcomes, including anxiety, depression, low self-esteem, and interpersonal difficulties, as well as reduced academic and social achievement. Such intrafamilial conflict may, in addition, elevate the incidence, rate, and severity of borderline personality disorder, particularly among females, narcissism, and psychopathy, although direction of causality in such cases is not precisely clear, and the process is most likely bidirectional. This propensity for sibling rivalry is in turn a reflection of the comparatively helpless and dependent state of the newborn human infant. Because human beings are born earlier than mammals, even primates, of comparable body mass or size, we experience a uniquely extended period of postnatal pre-adult dependency. Human infants and children require a tremendous investment of attention, and conflicts for that scarce resource within a family are therefore very likely to emerge. This potential for conflict is likely to be exacerbated if the siblings in question are born in quick succession, as their periods of maximal dependence then overlap. The recommended waiting time is 2 to 3 years, although there are no doubt other disadvantages associated with such spacing. The probability of conflict is particularly high when siblings are of the same sex and, therefore, fighting for more similarly available resources. It is implied, at minimum by omission, in the texts of the Cain and Abel narrative, that such close spacing occurs in the case of the brothers in question, as nothing happens, at least nothing worthy of note, in the time separating the birth of one from the other. If a new baby arrives when an older sibling is 1 or 2 years of age, the older child is almost immediately no longer the baby, and certainly not the primary baby. The mother, therefore, must sacrifice some of the attention she had been giving to the older child and turn it to the newborn, while the previous baby has to accept not being the baby anymore. He or she may be enticed with care into accepting the benefits of an expanded maturity, but can also become jealous of the interloper, and in a very angry and profound manner. Such familial conflicts do not necessarily attenuate or disappear as maturity progresses, and can remain intense throughout adulthood. There is an analogous divergence of interest in the story with regard to the comparative position of farmer, Cain, and rancher, Abel. This is sibling rivalry echoed at a more distant social level. Those who differentially occupy these positions are likely to run into disputes over property rights, access to grazing land, and, in the modern world, pesticide or other chemical use. Such conflicts occur in traditional and modern societies alike. The Cain and Abel story presents these more distal social struggles as variants of the pattern established in an arguably more basic sense by brothers, battling most fundamentally and primally, even while still in the womb, as in the later case of Esau and Jacob. He took his brother by the heel in the womb, and by his strength he had power with God, Hosea 12:3. Variants include, in his vigor he wrestled with God, Berean Standard Bible. Jacob is born explicitly on the heel of his brother, Genesis 25:26. His very name, arguably derived from the Hebrew Ekab, means one who seeks to trip up or supplant, who is, as if from the first, desirous to pull his brother back and get in front of him. The character of the man was thus prefigured at birth, overreaching or outwitting by cunning and strategy. Two brothers are destined to war. Two dramatic personages war within our breasts. Two spirits divide us. within our communities, the upward and downward aims eternally compete for the possession of the soul of man. This motif of deadly opposition is perhaps foremost among the archetypal tropes characterizing popular fiction and other forms of dramatic entertainment, certainly in the action and adventure genre, although opposition between paired brothers or their equivalent also features in romance. Consider, for example, Disney's Beauty and the Beast. J.K. Rowling's juvenile wizard Harry Potter is opposed, as a boy and young man, to Draco Malfoy, although even more fundamentally in his ultimate super wizard guise, to Voldemort, he who must not be named. The danger posed by the former is, as we shall see, not least a consequence of the interpenetration of the latter as a consequence of the deepest ongoing battle. This partial possession also characterizes Potter himself, who serves unwittingly as a horcrux for his archenemy, carrying unwittingly within him a piece of the Dark One's soul. That theme of shadow within hero is very well developed in the Batman film series, particularly in The Dark Knight, in which the Joker, Batman's arch nemesis, tempts Batman continually to adopt his own dark and anarchically destructive attitude, not least to successfully overcome the Joker himself. The same trope manifests itself in the opposition between DC Comics characters Superman and Lex Luthor, Marvel's Thor and Loki, and the characters of Frodo and Gollum in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings trilogy. The protagonist of heroic humility embodied in The Hobbit is contrasted as well with the arrogance and pride of the overweening Sauron, master of the One Ring of, what else could it be, power, in a manner very much akin to the portrayal of the relationship between Potter and Voldemort. This is an indication of the patterning of one of the hostile brothers, the one with downward aim, on the archetype of Lucifer or Satan, the spirit that most truly or deeply stands behind all proximal or personal manifestations of the arch-villain. It is no coincidence, therefore, that the primary antagonist of such stories is frequently both intellectually arrogant and a worshiper of technology. Consider in this light the age-old juxtaposition of Lucifer with the intellect. The Miltonian Lucifer is the light bringer, God's highest angel, gone most wrong, the prideful intellect. Goethe's Mephistopheles is the temptation posed to the arch-intellectual Faust. This relationship is reflected in popular culture, in the character of the villain Scar in The Lion King, the enemy both of tradition, Mufasa, and the young, reborn, and rightful king, Simba, of Felonious Gru of Despicable Me fame, of Jafar in Aladdin, of Syndrome in The Incredibles, and of Tolkien's aforementioned Sauron, creator of the One Ring, breeder of the monstrous orc, and architect of Barad-dûr, Babel-like tower of the all-seeing dark eye. The intellectually arrogant and presumptuous also have a pronounced tendency to turn to technological solutions solely to redress the apparent iniquities of being. This is not to say that the enterprise of building is intrinsically evil. In its proper place, it is good, or even very good. But the presumptuous builders take false pride in the productions of their imagination and attempt to attribute to themselves the talent that makes such enterprise possible. We will return to that theme when we analyze the relationship between the descendants of Cain and the erection of the Tower of Babel. The possibility for essential conflict is constant, a reflection of our biology at its deepest level and of our hypersociality, social dependence, and striving for relative position. This is why the very brief narrative of Cain and Abel immediately makes sense when we read it, even if we cannot explicitly say why. Conflict has a pattern, eternally emerging in families, among siblings, and in more distant but still analogous rivals. The motif of the hostile brothers represents, in both character and plot, the endless battle between opposed modes of sacrifice, forms of work, ways of sacrificing in relationship to the unity of the future, and visions of what that unity might be. The very deepest of storytellers do not necessarily split the hostile brothers into separate characters. To be clear, they tend to portray the interplay of opposed modes of sacrifice within the soul of each individual, protagonist and antagonist alike. It is also clearly the case, and for the same reason, that the most realistic and believable of heroes are by no means perfect people, and so are interpenetrated to some interesting and necessary degree by the spirit of Cain, while the most compelling villains are clearly those in whom some good still dwells. The mafia or other organized criminal characters dramatized so successfully by American filmmakers provide very good examples of the latter. Consider, for example, Tony Soprano in The Sopranos, or Walter White, or even more so, Jesse Pinkman in Breaking Bad. This is something also obviously true of many of Dostoevsky's characters, the prime example perhaps being Crime and Punishment's Raskolnikov, the complex family members portrayed in The Brothers Karamazov, and the various abstract idol worshippers of the possessed or the demons. The most dramatic representations of such conflict constitute the very soul of great literature. The story of Cain and Abel is an attempt by the collective human imagination to distill, transmit, and remember the essentials of good and bad into a single narrative. How did we come to undertake this effort? One answer would be divine inspiration, and that is a good answer at a very high order level of analysis. Another, in truth, a variant of the first answer, is that people have been telling each other stories forever, acting them out perhaps even before that, and that some of the stories were more pointed, interesting, and memorable than others. Particular instances of what is good and bad drew attention and were remembered. These were then distilled into something approximating their central tendency or essence. The greatest stories, told by the best storytellers, gripped people's attention in an unforgettable manner and burned themselves into imagination and concept, collective and personal. This might be regarded as a collaboration between the image and word, the logos, that gripped attention, and the image and word, the logos, that compelled memory. This collaboration continued for tens and perhaps hundreds of thousands of years. Stories thus told and remembered became better and better and simultaneously deeper and deeper. And no one wrote them or invented them precisely, or more accurately, perhaps, everyone did. And that is the action, so to speak, of Jung's collective unconscious. 3.3. The sacred patterning of the political. Much of the divide that bedevils the world is a consequence of the opposition of the two attitudes that are so definitively portrayed in the original biblical story of the hostile brothers. The story of Cain and Abel, therefore, has a significance that extends directly into the political as well, or more accurately, constitutes the political, insofar as the sacred has collapsed into it. It constitutes the pattern for the victim-victimizer narrative that plays such a key role in the ideologies of resentment that so truly characterize our time, although not uniquely, as the drama thus portrayed is eternal. The story is a meta-truth, a frame within which the facts of the world are held to reveal themselves, a structure that defines all the truths those who dally with ideological possession are capable of seeing and of acting on. What is the game? Believers in such stories, devotees of such theories, first note, and with gleeful dismay, the obvious disparities that exist in the world, a feat no different than observing the qualitative differences between things that most truly make up the world. Those who resentfully dwell upon the fact of such distinctions, of sex, race, class, ethnicity, gender, attractiveness, even age, weight, height, then point an accusing finger at those who unequally benefit from their positioning at the desirable end of the resultant distribution. Finally, they presume, in the most self-serving imaginable manner, that all such inequality, which is an inevitable consequence of difference itself, is something due instead to compulsion, force, and oppression. This hypothesis is particularly pernicious in that the accusation that it constitutes always contains a kernel of truth. No society is so pure that the inevitably differentiated rewards that it offers are awarded purely on the basis of merit, however that is defined. Power, and even corrupted power, as the two go so often hand in hand, always play at least some role. Some of those who are rich are narcissists and manipulative psychopaths, even in the highly functional and generally honest and productive societies of the West. Some of those who have social status have it because of dynasty and nepotism, which are the classic pathways to relative success in societies that do not rely on more abstracted and objective measurements of merit. The fact that corrupted routes to success do exist and are utilized by some corrupt individuals, does not in any way indicate that all such routes are corrupted, or worse, that all those who are successful are also corrupt. When a society assumes the latter, or when the latter has become true, then all hell is likely to break loose. It might be finally noted, the division into group categories of oppression and attribution of the resultant inequality to nothing but power, does not yet exhaust the game. The simplification that such a conceptual scheme constitutes means that all responsibility to think further is lifted. All social arrangements are made between oppressor and oppressed, whether of the couple, family, business, town, state, country, or religion. This is also very convenient, but no more so than is the conjoined opportunity for instant and undeserved moral virtue. Once the world is divided such that those unfairly on top have been segregated conceptually from those unfairly suffering on the bottom, the pathway to messianic status is magically revealed. Moral effort becomes nothing but allyship with the victims, however hypothetical, merely emotional, purely conceptual, or self-serving, even psychopathic, that allyship might be. The resentful, then murderous, then genocidal Jacobins who first planned the French Revolution and then took it over completely were the spiritual descendants of Cain. Karl Marx is Cain to the core, construing society as nothing but a battleground of power, assuming that any qualitative judgment regarding the value of comparative sacrifice is a game rigged by the victors. He failed completely and purposefully to separate wheat from chaff in the totalizing condemnation of the bourgeoisie, regarding them in consequence of their success as only parasites, predators, and thieves, and gave no credit whatsoever for the wealth and stable societal structure they produced as a result of their conscientious, diligent, honest, and productive labor. The modern meta-Marxists, the postmodern power players, have, as it were, metastasized Marx, but more deeply the spirit of Cain, extending the diagnosis of corrupted power to every possible categorization by group that can be applied to man and woman. All success, according to such accounts, takes place in the landscape of misery, characterized by intrinsically scarce and limited resources. All the games that people might play and find comparative success or failure within are games of force and compulsion, all equal in their intrinsic value or lack thereof. They are not games at all, but battlegrounds of tyrant and slave, with the roles distributed involuntarily and in a purely deterministic or socially constructed manner. All the successful contenders in such pathological contests win because they hoard and deprive, and all those who fail, and on any dimension whatsoever, do so unfairly through no fault of their own. In keeping with such presumptions, there is held to be no true work, no conscientious striving or effort, a conclusion obviously much to the benefit of the truly psychopathic, predatory, parasitical, and worse. Such hypotheses are much to the benefit of those who wish only to use power and force to obtain their essentially hedonistic and narrowly self-centered goals. Worse yet, much to the benefit of those who justify their striving after power with the claim that all games are, in the final analysis, battles of power, and that anyone who claims the contrary is merely revealing the depth of their capacity to selfishly manipulate. It is with such rationales that the stage is set for the dominion of hell, which is the eternal stage play of those who jockey for nothing but comparative status, and for the rise to predominance within the confines of that terrible drama of the worst of all possible devils. This is a consequence of the imitation of Cain and the fate of the Canaanites, the children of Cain, who are constantly defeated in the biblical tales by those who live by the Logos and pledge their devotion truly to God. 3.4. The Good Shepherd as Archetypal Leader. And Abel was a keeper of sheep. Genesis 4:2. Why a keeper of sheep? In the Old Testament, the image of the shepherd appears constantly, in a literal sense, and is a metaphor for spiritual leadership. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. Psalms 23:1-2. Isaiah echoes such sentiments in relationship to the character of God. He shall feed his flock like a shepherd. He shall gather the lambs with his arm and carry them in his bosom, and shall gently lead those that are with young. Isaiah 40:11. Insisting as well that lost humanity can be understood most profoundly through the metaphor of straying sheep, a trope referred back to in the New Testament. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. Isaiah 53:6. Ezekiel 34:2-3 upbraids the shepherds of Israel for attending to their own narrow needs before considering the people. Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say unto them, thus saith the Lord God unto the shepherds, woe be to the shepherds of Israel that do feed themselves. Should not the shepherds feed the flocks? Ye eat the fat, and ye clothe thee with the wool. Ye kill them that are fed, but ye feed not the flock. When the patriarch Jacob, then Israel, delivers his blessing upon Joseph, to take a further example, he does so as follows. Then he blessed Joseph and said, May the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked faithfully, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has delivered me from all harm, may he bless these boys. Genesis 48:16, New International Version. Shepherds in biblical times faced a stunningly difficult environment, one requiring endurance, skill, and courage. Shepherds had to protect their flocks from predators, including wolves and lions, navigate treacherous terrain to locate food and water, and endure extremes of heat and cold. The young David is precisely such a hero shepherd. He faces the giant Philistine warrior, the archetypal prepared enemy, with nothing but a slingshot, a skill with which he has developed while caring for his flock. God selected David for precisely such virtues. He also chose David, his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds, from following the ewes, great with young. He brought him to feed Jacob, his people, and Israel, his inheritance. So he fed them, alternative, shepherded them, New King James Version, according to the integrity of his heart, and guided them by the skillfulness of his hands. Psalms 78:70-72. Thus, the shepherd is an image of the mightiest hero, albeit in ordinary guise, armed with little but courage and faith, successfully confronting the worst in nature and man, while devoting his service to the least and most vulnerable. These are precisely the crucial yet paradoxical masculine virtues captured by Michelangelo's statue of David, with its great hands and stance of strength, grace, and ready alertness. That statue is simultaneously ideal and reproach, target and judge, and contains within it the terror of the beauty that eternally does the same thing and that frightens and intimidates people into a careless, second-rate taste and aesthetic ethos. Kitsch does not discriminate or judge, appealing cheaply to sentiment and the hypocritical moral virtue of the reflexively compassionate. Hence, for example, the sentimental attractiveness of the ceramic plates adorned with kittens, famously favored by J.K. Rowling's Dolores Umbridge, underworld queen of the do-gooding authoritarians. To be a shepherd is also to lead and to guide, and to do that in a caring manner, despite the ability to stave off predators. That means that the classic shepherd is in some real sense the ideal man, the eminently and persistently desirable combination of someone monstrous enough to confront and master the beasts that lurk in the night, yet productive, kind, and generous enough to provide and share. Such men are the true target of both women's innermost desire and of the proclivity of men to admire their fellows, even though both can be fooled in their admiration by narcissistic, psychopathic, manipulative, and even sadistic pretenders. This admirable dual proclivity has to come from the heart as well and cannot be purchased or faked, unlike its false, manipulative, and instrumental counterpart. It is for such reasons that Christ says of himself, "I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd giveth his life for the sheep. But he that is an hireling and not the shepherd, whose own the sheep are not, seeth the wolf coming, and leaveth the sheep, and fleeth, and the wolf catcheth them, and scattereth the sheep. The hireling fleeth, because he is an hireling, and careth not for the sheep." John 10:11-13. When properly integrated, the traits that might also predispose someone to callousness, uncaring, and even psychopathy can constitute the very basis for an implacable courage and strength. Women dispense with most men in their choice of partner because finding someone who optimally walks the line is very difficult, not least because it is genuinely difficult, in fact, to walk it. The eternal quandary of women? If I find the right man, he will keep away the monsters. But if I get one who is too monstrous himself, then I'm in trouble, even though he might be perversely sexy. He will be a monster to me as well as to others, and that is not a good plan. I need to find someone who is half monster and half kind. It is for this reason that the civilizable monster is arguably the prime character in both the romantic and pornographic fiction preferred by women. Best of luck locating or being him. When we sacrifice, we bargain with the future. We give up something now in the faith that our offering will be returned and with interest. The future is the unrealized horizon of possibility, the chaos that obtained at the beginning of time, the potential that still confronts our logos in the here and now, the very realm of trouble and opportunity or dragon and treasure that eternally confronts us. When we sacrifice, when we work, we establish what is in effect a contractual relationship with that possibility and simultaneously with the community, our future higher or deeper self, and becoming itself. We are, in effect, making a deal. I will give up something now. As a result, I will receive something and something better in the future. It might be argued that this deal is made not with God, but with the social world, even the patriarchy. In such a case, what is construed in religious terms as the covenant becomes something more like the classic social contract. I work for others and store up reputation and favor. That is repaid to me in the future. Alternatively, I invest in or work my property, the right to which is bestowed upon me by social agreement, as is the right to benefit from my investment. This assumption of mere social contract is an ill-advised and false move, however, both conceptually and ontologically. Societies only retain their viability, and at every level of complexity from couple to state, when they are predicated on an underlying ethos that is not itself mere agreement, although such agreement is necessary. Something deeper is required, some reflection of a deeper reality, one that is the precondition for the genuine establishment and maintenance of the necessary agreements of the social world, one that is predicated, for example, on respect for both God and the soul, and therefore for the individual. All games are not equally playable. Failure to recognize this stark fact is a or the fundamental flaw of the moral relativist and idiot ideology-possessed revolutionary alike, and the presumptions of the former tend to be those of the latter, and vice versa. If society loses all respect for the integrity of the person and degenerates into a consequent nihilism or hedonism or striving for dominance, then the social contract will immediately become unsustainable. In a word, moot. This happens all the time in moments of revolution or ideological possession, and the results are inevitably dire. If society is not structured such that the primary relationships within it are both voluntary and responsible, that is, sacrificial and in the upward manner, then the arrangements made between people will not truly be agreements. They will instead be outright lies. That is, contracts that no one involved with has any intention of fulfilling, attempts to gain the upper hand for the delights of even fleeting status or permanent power, or impulsive, narrowly self-focused and temporary manifestations of immature whim. No contracts of that nature will hold, particularly not in times of trouble. People will not cooperate upward under such conditions. Neither will they compete productively according to the rules, nor honor the deals they have made, which are not deals at all, but they're Luciferian parodies. What was the infamous old Soviet joke? And it's a good one. We pretend to work, and they pretend to pay us. If the social order is not logos predicated, in other words, it will not be the order that is good, and certainly not the order that is very good. It might very well be hell instead. Hell, at least in its earthly form, and is even in that form something that will be experienced as well nigh eternal. This relationship to what is highest, simultaneously personal and contractual, is what is meant in the deepest sense by covenant. God refers to this covenant when he tells Cain, as we shall see, that he would be accepted if he only did what was right, Genesis 4:7. There is a very deep connection between this idea of contract or covenant and the idea that man should exist in relationship with what is to be properly placed at the pinnacle or serve as proper foundation. How is this to be understood? Consider this. Our personalities are our means of adaptation to the world in the broadest sense, to the psychological, social, and natural worlds considered as a unity. We regard what is most central to us as conscious beings as our personality. We know and treat ourselves and one another as personalities. We identify with our personalities, and personalities exist, by definition, in relationship. We are organized at the supreme level of our being as personalities. Personality, to put it another way, is our chosen mode of adaptation, of being in the world, our essence, our spirit. We face the world as personalities. We have evolved, even speaking scientifically, as personalities. Personalities cannot exist except in relationship. Thus, it is by no means unreasonable, and may in fact be reasonably regarded as necessary, to deem our sacrificial covenant with the future, our potential selves, with others, and with the pattern of the cosmic order, as a relationship. Why? To say it again, because we inevitably exist as human beings in relationship. This consideration, however, begs another fundamental question. Relationship with what or who? The answer, at minimum, with the future, toward whose improvement we eternally work, to whose betterment we sacrifice, with those around us, parents, children, wives and husbands, friends, co-workers, fellow citizens and souls, with the order of the natural world, balanced with that of the community. More deeply, with the spirit of the Creator itself as it makes itself manifest across situation and time. And ask yourself this from your no doubt still dubious atheist, materialist, and Darwinian stance. Why would we be organized at the highest level of identity as a sacrificing or working personality, with all the attendant assumption of relationship that would justify such organization, if doing so were anything other than a functional means of adaptation to what is most deeply real? And that is not all. There is also no escaping from the necessity of the hypothesis of personality and even necessarily sacrificial personality in relationship to any manifestation of the inevitable patterning of attention and action. This is even true if we are impulsive and immature, if we are governed, for example, by hedonistic whim. Such a whim is nothing but a short-term covenant. If I pursue this immediate desire in this particular way, I may obtain what I want. The hedonist merely sacrifices to the short-term sequential gods of his whim, instead of to some higher order or deeper psychological and social unity. Why sacrifice? At least because he allows himself to be pulled one way, here and now, rather than any of the many other ways that might clamor to do such polling. Also, because he offers up the integrated, responsible, and adventurous future self he might have been had he foregone his immaturity to the pleasures of the moment. Shades of Peter Pan and the Lost Boys, shades of Pinocchio and the slavish delinquents of Pleasure Island. The hedonist, possessed by his desire, may even identify with that god in the moment or even quasi-permanently. Quasi because there will be no real commitment, as that would require precisely the sacrifice that is being rejected. He may presume ownership, or more truly, sovereignty over his current whim. I am what it is that wants within me. Claim sexual proclivity or other desire, for example, as the very hallmark of personal being and becoming. This makes every hedonist a polytheist, willing to invite in and to celebrate or worship, that is, to place at the pinnacle or make foundational, the diverse range of spirits corresponding to his or her momentary impulses and drives. All claims to the contrary, however, someone possessed by lust, anger, hunger, or envy is not the master of that ancient motivation or hierarchy of motivation, but its slave. The orgiastic and materialistic worshippers of the golden calf are hardly masters of their own fate. 3.5, the sacrifice pleasing to God. Once an understanding or conceptualization of the necessity of sacrifice or work and of their identity is established, new questions immediately and inevitably arise in the imagination of the seeker of the truth. What work works best? What sacrifices, to use the symbolic representation, will be most enthusiastically accepted by self, fellow man, and natural world, will most please God? Understood in this manner, the question of proper offering is properly conceived as ultimate in its difficulty, no different than asking, what is the purpose or meaning of life? Cain and Abel, standing at the very dawn of profane history, face that abysmal or heavenly mystery directly in the immediate aftermath of their parents' fall and expulsion and the subsequent entry of obstacle and toil into the world. The interaction between the diametrically opposed and hostile brothers establishes the pattern of the great drama of temptation that forever characterizes our familial and social relationships and the course of our own hearts. One spirit, one pattern of fraternal and religious attention and action, exists in absolute opposition to the other. One brother habitually offers to the world and God what is apparently required to maintain the optimal relationship with the earthly and the highest. The other cannot or refuses to do so, fails, shakes his fist at God in rage, and then kills the first, his very ideal. Abel's offerings are acceptable to God, Cain's are not. And the Lord had respect unto Abel and to his offering, but unto Cain and to his offering he had not respect. Genesis 4:4-5. But what does Abel do in comparison and contrast with his unhappy brother? He works honestly and hard, sacrificing most diligently and completely, offering what is both firstborn and of the highest quality. What is firstborn is the intent of an offering, a piece of work, a job. It sets the tone, establishes the pattern, and constitutes the aim. What is of highest quality is first without blemish, thus the perfect offering, and then that which provides the most value, represented in the image-laden and symbolic language of the story, as the richest of all possible sources of food. The divine requirement for quality in necessary and acceptable sacrifice is a theme returned to and developed thoroughly in many of the following biblical texts. The book of Leviticus, part of the accounts of the exploits and adventures of Moses and the chosen people, provides a further elaboration, a step forward in codification or explicit representation. Ye shall offer at your own will a male without blemish of the beeves, of the sheep, or of the goats. But whatsoever hath a blemish, that shall ye not offer, for it shall not be acceptable for you. And whosoever offereth a sacrifice of peace offerings unto the Lord to accomplish his vow, or a free will offering in beeves or sheep, it shall be perfect to be accepted.